Here we go with the reading of today's Wall Street Journal for Tuesday, the 16th of April, 2024. With the Wall Street Journal today, we say hello to John.
Good morning. This is your reader, John Michael, for the Wall Street Journal. Israel gauges retaliatory strike following Iran's aerial assault. Israel intends to punish Tehran for the drone and missile barrage that represented Iran's first ever direct attack on its territory, Israeli officials said, but it faces a difficult challenge of finding a way of doing so that avoids further escalation, preserves the partnership that helped fend off the assault, and doesn't derail its war aims in Gaza. Israel's war cabinet met on Monday to discuss how and when to respond to Iran's attack, which Tehran said was in response to the killing by Israel of a senior Iranian general at an Iranian diplomatic building in Damascus, Syria. Israel hasn't confirmed or denied the involvement. We are looking ahead and considering our steps. The launching of so many missiles, cruise missiles, and drones into Israeli territory will be met with a response, said the head of Israel's military, Herzi Halevi, during a visit to an Israeli Air Force base damaged by the Iranian attack. Halevi said while Israel could manage alone with such a widespread and distant threat, we are always happy to have support, and he singled out U.S. support. Israel faces an increasingly delicate set of political calculations. It is already fighting on three fronts, in Gaza against Hamas, on its northern border with Hezbollah, as well as trying to quell unrest in the West Bank. Now, it is under pressure to restore deterrence with Iran amid calls from allies to exercise restraint. Decision makers must balance the need to project strength with their desire to hold together a tenuous strategic partnership against Iran that helped it block the attack. The point is to respond smartly in a way that won't undermine the opportunity for regional and international cooperation that we created, said Michael Oren, a former Israeli ambassador to the U.S. President Biden has urged Israel to use caution in any response to Iran's attack and pressed allies on Sunday for a united diplomatic front in a bid to stop the hostilities from spiraling into open warfare that could engulf the Middle East and entangle the U.S. Together with our partners, we defeated the attack, Biden said on Monday, while meeting with Iraqi Prime Minister Mohammed al-Sudani. Biden said the U.S. was committed to Israel's security. We're committed to a ceasefire that will bring the hostages home and prevent the conflict from spreading beyond where it already has. Saturday's attack demonstrated the importance of an Israeli relationship with the U.S. Some analysts said that will likely be a key consideration as Israel weighs its next move and seeks to capitalize on the show of international support the assault triggered. In the weeks before Iran's attack, Israel had faced weeks of criticism over the mounting death toll in Gaza and failure to agree to a ceasefire. In light of the successful defense against Iran's attack, Israeli military spokesperson Daniel Hagari said Israel's range of possible responses are wider and greater. He said Israelis could receive new safety instructions in the coming days, similar to those that preceded the Iranian attack, suggesting an Israeli response could come soon. John Kirby, a spokesperson for the White House National Security Council, said the U.S. wasn't involved in Israelis' decision-making about a potential response. This is an Israeli decision to make whether and how they'll respond to what Iran did on Saturday. Israel's strained relationship with the Biden administration also might be playing into Iran's thinking, said Sanam Vakil, a Middle East expert at the UK's Chatham House think tank. I think the Islamic Republic has decided that if Israel and Iran are going into an escalatory cycle, it's better to do it now, during the Biden administration, she said. The head of Iran's Islamic Revolution Guard Corps, Major General Hossein Salami, said on Sunday that Iran would respond to future Israeli attacks on Iran-linked targets from Iranian soil, potentially opening the door for escalatory responses from Israel. Operations in Gaza are also part of the Israeli calculus, including a planned offensive in the crowded city of Rafah, which Israel sees as crucial to eliminating Hamas and freeing dozens of hostages still held in the enclave. But that is opposed by Israel's close allies and Arab neighbors who came to its defense on Saturday. Israeli strikes on Rafah continued in recent days, even up to the moment of the Iranian attack that began late Saturday, people living in the city said. On Monday, Israeli Defense Minister Yoav Gallant said he discussed preparations for the civilian evacuation of Rafah with security officials. On Sunday, Israel said Hamas had rejected a U.S. proposal for the release of hostages. Militarily, some analysts said Israel's decision regarding Iran and Gaza may not be linked, but they are connected politically. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's right-wing base is disgruntled that the ground operation in Rafah hasn't taken place and doesn't seem imminent, since Israel has pulled out most of its soldiers out of Gaza. Israel is calling up 2 reserve brigades in the coming days for reinforcement in Gaza, but will need more forces for any major operation. Now, Netanyahu's supporters want a strong retaliation against Iran as well. Netanyahu told ministers from his Likud party that he is determined to respond to Iran, but that the action would be sensible and not something irresponsible, a person familiar with the matter said. Failure to act against Iran or in Rafah could further harm Netanyahu's already diminished political support, said Chuck Frelich, a former Israeli deputy national security advisor. Even if he wants to show restraint on both fronts, he has to balance that. Chinese money flows to U.S. universities. Chinese companies are feeling a cold shoulder in the U.S., except at universities, where they are welcomed as customers. American universities sign contracts around the world to sell their research and training expertise, and some of their most lucrative agreements have been with the companies based in China. The decades-long trade thrives despite a deepening U.S.-China rivalry and rising sensitivities about Beijing's influence on American campuses. Nearly 200 U.S. colleges and universities held contracts with Chinese businesses valued at $2.32 billion between 2012 and 2024, according to a review by the Wall Street Journal of disclosures made to the Education Department. The journal tallied roughly 2,900 contracts. The extensive trade and American expertise presents a quandary for universities and policymakers in Washington. Where's the line between fostering academic research and empowering a U.S. rival? It seems clear that when the Chinese contract with U.S. universities, they are getting a capability they can't get elsewhere, said Daniel Carell, a Trump administration Education Department official who has tracked foreign influence in higher education. The big question is, what contract should be legal and what should be legal and disclosable and what should be illegal, he added. In some cases, an American university whose identity is tied to a bedrock local industry, think cars in the University of Michigan or the University of Florida and citrus, does research on behalf of a Chinese challenger in that same sector. All three of China's major government-owned oil companies have funded contracts for $100,000 or more at the University of Texas at Austin, which the school describes only as research activity. U.S. universities earn money from virtually every nation in the form of tuition, gifts, and contracts. In the journal analysis, Qatar provided more non-tuition money into U.S. universities than any other country following the U.K., Germany, and China. Gifts draw more publicity because they are often large dollar amounts from individuals that confer, let's say, naming rights for a new building. But overall, the contract world involves far more money. Universities are required to report any foreign gift or contract worth $250,000 or more to the Education Department, though the rule historically wasn't vigorously enforced, and the agency has alleged billions have gone unreported. Journal reporting also found instances of double counting and other data errors. Calls are growing on Capitol Hill to vet Chinese contracts with U.S. schools for national security risks. The journal made public records requests to major public universities in all 50 states for details of their contracts with entities in China. The disclosures reveal how contracts cut across industries where Beijing has subsidized or otherwise supported Chinese enterprises, from medicine and agriculture to manufacturing and even the arts. Schools say the practice of matching Chinese funding with American expertise often serves the public good, like developing new cancer treatments. Yet, to critics, the Communist Party's control over China's business sector can taint even those pursuits. That's the conundrum facing U.S. universities that have entered contracts with Shanghai-based Wuxi AppTech, known in China as Huawei Technologies of Pharma. AppTech is a biotech conglomerate globally recognized for medical breakthroughs and manufacturing therapies approved by the Food and Drug Administration. But like Huawei, China's now blacklisted maker of advanced telecommunications gear, it is now dogged by concerns in Washington its innovations could be abused by Beijing. Both AppTech and Huawei have had contracts with U.S. universities, the journal found. The companies say they are private enterprises and reject suggestions that they take directions from China's government or pose national security risks to the U.S. The University of Arizona valued three AppTech contracts it reported for 2022, collectively at around $1.5 million. Among them is an agreement in which a services arm of AppTech, on behalf of another Chinese drug maker, agreed to pay the university's hospital $36,977 for each subject enrolled in trials of a drug designed to treat tumors. The medicine FDA approval for treatment during the trial are rare cancers. Now, out of concern Beijing could harness commercial biological discoveries for military purposes, members of Congress want the government to classify AppTech as adversary biotech company of concern, which would make it virtually untouchable as a partner for U.S. organizations that get federal dollars. Wuxi AppTech and its sister company Wuxi Biologics are rapidly becoming a global pharmaceutical and research services giant that threatens U.S. intellectual property and national security, read a February letter signed by four members of the House Committee on China to U.S. government agencies requesting the new classification. AppTech said the legislative effort targeting it is misguided and without a fair and transparent review of the facts. Arizona spokeswoman Pam Scott, said by email, "We have not been notified of any security concerns." In early 2018, the University of Washington announced it would create one of the world's first academic centers dedicated to virtual and augmented reality. The university credited the center's $6 million funding, equally to Facebook, Google, and Huawei. After the Trump White House made it illegal for Americans to do many types of businesses with Huawei in May 2019, the university announced that federal regulations meant it could no longer enter into transactions with the Chinese company. The school reported over $5.5 million from Huawei across the years 2018, 2019, and 2021, and a spokesperson said the latter entry represented a final payment in the contract that began before 2019. A Huawei logo appears in a welcome video on the homepage of the university's reality lab, which the spokesman said is an accurate and transparent acknowledgement of Huawei's founding participation in the lab. Huawei didn't respond to questions about its contracts at U.S. universities, including Washington. There has not, until recently, been much concern about what's going on at universities, said Aaron Friedberg, a U.S.-China Economy and Security Review Commission member. The commission, which advises Congress, now urges legislation to treat Chinese contracts with universities like foreign-funded acquisitions, subject to national security screening through an interagency panel known as the Committee on Foreign Investment in the United States, or CFIUS. The concern, Freiberg said, is that contracts represent just one of the many avenues of access into our R&D technology establishment. A number of contracts identified by the journal provided China with specialized training it lacks. For instance, China has few small planes or public airstrips needed for pilot training. So for over a decade, major Chinese airlines such as Air China paid the University of North Dakota millions annually to get their recruits licensed to fly. Between October 2018 and July 2022 alone, North Dakota records detailed contracts worth over $37 million from four Chinese carriers. Student pilots at North Dakota's Aerospace Academy racked up their required 250 flight training hours from airstrips a few miles from Grand Forks Air Force Base, a control center for military drones and satellites. North Dakota declined to discuss its works with China's airlines, though university publications have said some 30% of Air China pilots trained there, and that their presence was a financial shot in the arm for the capital-intensive aerospace school. The Chinese airlines didn't respond to questions. Among foreign funders of U.S. schools, China raises particular complications, said Ian Oxnevad, a senior fellow at the National Association of Scholars, who argues U.S. universities don't need China's money and should be alert that its military can make use of seemingly civilian commercial applications. There's an ethical imperative to research, he said. For years, a prominent type of university contract involved Chinese language training on U.S. campuses under the rubric Confucius Institutes, such as the around $540,000 reported by the University of Oklahoma for 2019. After evidence piled up of the Beijing-funded institute's close ties to China's diplomatic missions, most closed, including Oklahoma's. Some of the biggest value China contracts feature franchise-type arrangements for overseas satellite campuses. New York University, which the Education Department database shows has been the largest single recipient of Chinese funding, reported two contracts totaling over $46.5 million for 2021 alone in its Shanghai branch. The Juilliard School has disclosed over $133 million in such funding over more than a decade for its Tijian Juilliard School, appointed with some 120 Steinway pianos. Successive American administrations have accused the Chinese Communist Party of treating U.S. campuses as beachheads to further its agenda. The Federal Bureau of Investigation and other agencies warn that China's state has encouraged theft of technological secrets at universities, spread pro-Beijing propaganda, stifled campus debate, and harassed students. Beijing dismisses such characterizations. It officials say ethnic Chinese students and professors have been unfairly targeted in the U.S., including on American campuses, and urge the U.S. to be mindful of its reputation for academic freedom. The Chinese embassy in Washington didn't respond to detailed questions about the university contracts. In the shadow of Detroit's auto industry, the University of Michigan said it has had around $1 million in contracts from Didi Global, a Chinese ride-sharing company built on government money that forced Uber out of the market. The university said Didi funding supported a range of engineering research, from evaluating devices for monitoring a driver's health and operational safety, to using a vehicle fleet to track air pollution, including 8 peer-reviewed scientific papers that made the findings public. International engagement is a foundational element of successful research, university spokesman Rich Fitzgerald said in a statement. Florida oranges long ago got squeezed out of the Chinese market by aggressive Chinese growers and protectionist policies, such as a 56% import tariff. Yet, China does have a taste for Florida's oranges. Anxious about a tree infection called greening that makes fruit taste acidic, scientists in China turn to the University of Florida, which has researched citrus diseases for more than a century. A disclosure from the school showed that contracts worth about $1.8 million with China's Institute of Naval Oranges at Gannon Normal University supported work by a Florida authority on tree genetics, who has made advances against citrus diseases. University spokesperson Chris Vivian said the contracts reflect the university's responsibilities to the agricultural community. The university's work studies wild citrus germplasms in China that are resistant and tolerant of greening, and local collaboration is necessary because under Chinese law, that material can't be shipped overseas, she said. Wang declined to comment. Emails to several people at China's Orange Institute went unanswered. Future Florida-China collaborations are now in doubt after Governor Ron DeSantis last year signed a law that could bar state-funded universities from entering contracts with partners from China, Russia, Iran, and 4 other nations. The governor's office said he aimed to root out Chinese influence in Florida's education system. The university declined to comment on the law or address its impact on the orange research. Tax day outage frustrates filers ahead of deadline. H&R Block said it experienced technology outages on Monday, temporarily preventing thousands of last-minute tax filers from sending in their returns. Some people who bought and downloaded the H&R Block software on their computers were unable to electronically file their returns. Those who use the company's software through a web browser or work directly with its tax professionals weren't impacted, H&R Block said. The outage started Sunday night and continued for most of Monday. An H&R Block spokeswoman said the company fixed the problem by around 4 p.m. EDT on Monday. The filing deadline for tax returns in all but two U.S. states was 11:59 p.m. on Monday. Millions of Americans rely on online tax preparation services to help them fill out the appropriate forms and send them to the Internal Revenue Service. H&R Block, one of the largest tax preparation companies, had told some customers experiencing issues that they could print out their forms and send them to the IRS by mail. The IRS encourages e-filing, warning that processing paper returns takes several weeks longer. Paper filers who are owed refunds can experience delays receiving them. H&R Block said it has received about 2,000 inquiries related to the technology outage so far. More than 20 million taxpayers filed with H&R Block last year. Users posted on social media that they were getting error messages and repeat pending credit card charges for multiple filing attempts. Many taxpayers who procrastinate owe taxes. Late filing penalties and interest charges on balances due kick in one day after tax day. Separately, the Treasury Department said Monday that it met the goal of 100,000 taxpayers filing returns as part of the Direct File pilot program by midday on Sunday, with more than 50,000 taxpayers filing over the past week. U.S. Watch, New York. Diocese seeks to end Chapter 11 case. A nearly four-year effort to resolve hundreds of sex abuse claims in bankruptcy by one of the biggest U.S. Catholic dioceses appears headed toward failure after victims overwhelmingly rejected its latest settlement offer. The Diocese of Rockville Center in suburban Long Island on Friday filed court papers seeking to dismiss its own bankruptcy after clergy sex abuse survivors rejected what is described as its best and final settlement offer. Dismissing the case would free hundreds of lawsuits against the diocese and its parishes to move forward, according to lawyers for sex abuse plaintiffs. Judge Martin Glenn of the U.S. Bankruptcy Court in New York will have a final say on whether to dismiss the Chapter 11 case. Rockville Center moved to end its bankruptcy case without a settlement with abuse victims is unprecedented among the dozens of Catholic dioceses that went through Chapter 11 over two decades. Rockville Center filed Chapter 11 protection during a more recent spate of bankruptcies, stemming from laws passed in New York and other states to let people sue over sex abuse that occurred long ago. Six of eight Catholic dioceses in New York have filed for bankruptcy since the state in 2019, suspended its statute of limitations on sex abuse claims. Some of those dioceses have languished in bankruptcy as insurance companies took a tough line against paying to cover decades-old claims. A handful of dioceses elsewhere, including in Baltimore, Sacramento, and San Francisco, have filed for bankruptcy since last year. Rockville Center has been at loggerheads with victims in negotiations over a proposed deal. An official committee for victims has been pushing for dismissing the diocese case since last summer. Colorado, funeral home owners indicted. A couple who owned a Colorado funeral home where authorities last year discovered 190 decaying bodies were indicted on federal charges that they misspent nearly $900,000 in pandemic relief on vacations, cosmetic surgery, jewelry, and other personal expenses, according to court documents unsealed on Monday. The indictment reaffirms accusations from state prosecutors that John and Carrie Halford gave families dry concrete instead of cremated ashes and alleges the couple buried the wrong body on two occasions. The couple also collected more than $130,000 from families for cremations and burial services they never provided, the indictment said. The grand jury brought federal charges in addition to more than 200 criminal counts already pending against the Halfords in Colorado State Court for corpse abuse, money laundering, theft, and forgery. The 15 federal offenses carry potential penalties of 20 years in prison and $250,000 in fines, according to the indictment. The Halfords couldn't be reached for comment. Even before the new indictment, public records revealed that the Halfords had been plagued by debt, facing evictions and lawsuits for unpaid cremations, even as they spent lavishly. The indictment alleges the couple used $882,300 in pandemic release funds to buy items for themselves that also included a vehicle, dinners, tuition for their children, and cryptocurrency. The couple haven't entered pleas to the state's abuse of corpse charges. Carrie Halford's attorney in the state case declined to comment on the federal indictment. John Halford's attorney in the state case works for the Public Defender's Office, which doesn't comment on pending cases. Supreme Court weighs a new bribery case as more clashes brew. The Supreme Court for years has been making it more challenging for prosecutors to bring corruption cases against public officials, guided by the belief that some of the deal-making and fundraising in the political realm is unseemly but not illegal. A new batch of cases making their way through the courts shows that where to draw the line remains in flux. In New York, a U.S. appeals court recently revived the prosecution of a former lieutenant governor after a trial judge earlier tossed the charges. In Ohio, a group of top former Justice Department officials is criticizing the bribery prosecution of a former Cincinnati City Council member whose political action committee took money from undercover FBI agents posing as businessmen working with a developer. And the Supreme Court jumped back into the fray Monday in a case that examines the viability of prosecutions against officials who take gratuities after performing actions that helped their benefactors. The justices heard arguments in an appeal by James Snyder, the former mayor of Portage, Indiana, who was convicted of bribery in 2021. Portage needed new garbage trucks when Snyder took office. So he arranged a public bidding process. The city eventually awarded two contracts worth a combined $1.1 million to a local truck dealership whose owners Schneider was frequently calling and texting at the time. Not long after the second contract was awarded, the dealership gave Schneider a $13,000 check. The former mayor said the money was an upfront payment for future consulting services he was to provide. Prosecutors said the money was an illegal reward for Schneider directing city business to the dealership. Schneider, a Republican, was sentenced to 21 months in prison. The 7th U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals affirmed the conviction last year in a decision that highlighted a split in the lower courts on whether federal bribery law covers gratuities paid to public officials to reward them for acts they have already taken, as opposed to upfront payments made to secure a favor. The Supreme Court is poised to resolve that disagreement. Last year, the Supreme Court threw out a pair of corruption convictions stemming from the tenure of former Democratic New York Governor Andrew Cuomo. The court in one case sided with longtime Cuomo aide Joseph Percoco, who had been prosecuted for taking payments to assist a developer during a period when he had left his state job to run Cuomo's reelection campaign. The decision didn't accept all of Percoco's arguments, but the court found the jury instructions in the case had been flawed. In 2020, the Supreme Court unanimously tossed out a pair of public corruption convictions in the New Jersey scandal known as Bridgegate. And in a unanimous 2016 ruling, the court invalidated the conviction of former Virginia Governor Bob McDonnell. Some lawyers applaud these rulings as a safeguard against prosecutorial overreach. Others say the court has gone too far, effectively blessing a range of corrupt conduct. More cases could land at the high court soon. The Cincinnati case, now on appeal, has drawn interest from former Justice Department leaders. They argue federal prosecutors went too far in pursuing former city councilman Alexander P.G. Sittenfield, who was convicted of soliciting $20,000 in bribes for his political action committee. Prosecutors said Sittenfield, a Democrat, took the money in exchange for promising to vote for a development project. Sittenfield, who was serving a 16-month prison sentence, said he was simply a pro-development politician who touted those views while raising funds from developers. In New York, former Lieutenant Governor Brian Benjamin has pledged to petition the Supreme Court after an appeals court revived bribery charges against him, dating from his time as a state senator. Benjamin, a Democrat, is fighting charges that he funneled a $50,000 state grant to a real estate developer's nonprofit in Harlem in exchange for illegal campaign contributions. A trial judge threw out most of the case in 2022. But the judge also said there was a confusion among the courts about how bribery laws apply to campaign contributions. The 2nd U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals said last month that the prosecution was valid and could move forward. FBI opens probe into Baltimore bridge collapse. The FBI has opened a criminal investigation into the circumstances leading up to last month's deadly collapse of the Francis Scott Key Bridge in Baltimore, a law enforcement official said on Monday. The probe is examining issues including whether the crew aboard the container ship Dolly failed to report any problems with the vessel before it left port, the person said. The investigation was reported earlier by the Washington Post. A Federal Bureau of Investigation team consisting of more than a dozen agents boarded the ship Monday morning. Agents are looking into whether the Dolly had any previously unreported engine, steering, or electrical issues before leaving Baltimore for a voyage to Sri Lanka, a Coast Guard official said. He said agents spoke with members of the ship's crew. The FBI confirmed its agents were aboard the Dolly, but declined to comment further. The FBI and the National Transportation Safety Board is also investigating what happened to the Singapore-flagged container ship. The 980-foot Dolly slammed into the bridge around 1:30 a.m. on March 26th, knocking a large section of the span into the Patapsco River. Six workers who were patching potholes on the bridge died. The ship remains at the site of the bridge, with sections of the bridge resting on its bow. The bridge record has walled off most of Baltimore ports to ocean-going ships, including all but one of the vehicle terminals that made Baltimore the nation's top gateway for imported cars. The U.S. Army Corps of Engineers says it aims to remove enough debris to fully reopen the 50-foot deep channel by late May. A spokesman for Maryland Governor Wes Moore referred questions about the investigation to the FBI. Baltimore Mayor Brandon Scott said on Monday that the city had engaged two law firms to take unspecified legal action against the Dolly's owner, charterer, manager operator, and manufacturer, along with other potentially liable third parties. Scott, a Democrat, said the aim is to mitigate the short-term and long-term harm of the bridge collapse to city residents. Armorer in Baldwin film gets 18 months. Hannah Gutierrez-Reed, the armorer in charge of weapons on the set of Rust, where a cinematographer was fatally shot, was sentenced on Monday to 18 months in prison. Gutierrez-Reed was convicted of involuntary manslaughter in a New Mexico court in March over the 2021 killing of cinematographer Halina Hutchins. The judge said she gave Gutierrez-Reed the maximum sentence because the armorer should have checked the prop gun for live rounds before it fired at the 42-year-old Hutchins. Alec Baldwin, the film's star and co-producer, was holding the weapon. He is set to go on trial in July on an involuntary manslaughter charge. The actor has said he didn't pull the trigger and wasn't aware there was a live round in the gun. Judge Mary Marlowe Summer said Gutierrez-Reed had time to load the gun safely and she didn't take the responsibility. You alone turned a safe weapon into a lethal weapon. But for you, Ms. Hutchins would be alive. A husband would have his partner, and a little boy would have his mother, the judge said. Prosecutors asked for the maximum sentence of 18 months, saying Gutierrez Reed hasn't expressed remorse. Her lawyers said she had felt remorse. They are appealing the conviction and ask for her sentence to be probation. Gutierrez Reed was acquitted in March of a charge of tampering with evidence, court records show. Gutierrez Reed said her heart aches for the Hutchins family. Despite not having proper time, resources, and staffing when things got tough, I just did my best to handle it, she said. A prosecutor and a lawyer for Gutierrez Reed didn't return requests for comment. Prosecutors said Gutierrez Reed was unprofessional and left guns unattended. Gutierrez Reed, who was 24 at the time of the shooting, has said she isn't sure how live rounds got into her ammunition boxes. Authorities haven't determined how live rounds made it into the set either. Gutierrez Reed's lawyers blamed the prop shop that provided the rounds, and she was a scapegoat. In Trump's hush money case, the jury pool runs deep blue. Donald Trump's hush money trial began Monday in one of the bluest parts of the country, where a jury full of Democrats could decide the presumptive Republican presidential nominee's fate. Jury selection in the case involving the alleged cover-up of a payment to buy a porn star's silence got underway in the afternoon and could take a week or more. The presiding judge, as well as prosecutors and Trump's lawyers, are expected to question hundreds of prospective jurors to weed out anyone who can't set aside their views of a former president whose tenure sparked deep divisions. Picking an impartial jury on Democratic turf, where President Biden won 87% of the vote in the 2020 election, will be challenging, trial consultants say. I can't think of another place where he is more loathed than his hometown of New York City, litigation consultant Alan Turkenheimer said of Trump. Seating a jury proved tough from the outset. More than half of the initial group of the 96 prospective jurors brought in to answer questions were immediately dismissed. They had raised their hand when asked if they couldn't be fair and impartial. Another 9 were excused when asked if there were other reasons they couldn't serve. Trump, wearing a navy blue suit and red tie, said in the courtroom watching the selection process, "The former president looked engaged at times, asking his lawyers questions during the proceedings. Other times he closed his eyes for brief periods. The former president is required to attend the trial." Manhattan prosecutors charged Trump last year with 34 counts of falsifying business records to hide a payment to X-rated film star Stormy Daniels ahead of the 2016 election. It was the first of 4 criminal cases brought against Trump in state and federal courts, and may be the only case that wraps up ahead of the November election. Trump has denied any wrongdoing and accused Manhattan District Attorney Alvin Bragg, a Democrat, of charging him out of political spite. Trump's lawyers have said the former president can't get a fair trial in Manhattan, citing what they describe as negative media coverage of the case and strong anti-Trump sentiment among residents of the island. His legal team shared with the court a survey it commissioned that showed many Manhattan residents already believe Trump is guilty of at least some of the charges. His lawyers have asked a state appellate court to remove his trial to another location outside of Manhattan. The request is a long shot. Prospective jurors answered a list of questions Monday, including where they get their news and if they ever worked or volunteered for Trump's campaign or an anti-Trump organization. This is your reader, John Michael, for the Wall Street Journal. Have a good day.